This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting in for Joshua Johnson. Well, it finally happened. For the first time since the 2020 campaign season began, an official televised debate of Democratic presidential candidates managed to fit all on one stage and hash it all out on a single night. Now, not that the pool was totally full. There were a couple of hopefuls who didn't qualify for the event from Houston, but the field of Dems is starting slowly to get smaller. Well, just the opposite of what's happening in the GOP. Donald Trump's bid for re-election is now facing challenges from three fellow Republicans, including former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, who announced his candidacy this week. Policy ideas and campaign messaging are starting to come together and gain more visibility, but it's easy for frontrunners to lose their footing in this phase of the political season. What did we hear and learn about the candidates this week? We'll discuss that and much more of the week's top news on the roundup today. I'm joined by Shauna Thomas. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News. She's in New York on this Friday. Shauna, good to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me, Todd.
Shane Harris is here from The Washington Post. He covers intelligence and national security. He's also author of At War, The Rise of the Military Internet Complex. Welcome back, Shane.
Good to see you, Todd.
And Eliana Johnson is here, White House reporter for Politico. Eliana's also the incoming brand new editor-in-chief of The Washington Free Beacon, some news that Washington got this week. Congratulations, Eliana.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And good to have you here as well. Well, let's start with politics, because if you crave brutal, bone-crunching battles on live television, you could have watched the NFL on Thursday night. But the real bloodlusters opted for Dem-on-Dem violence. They watched the third Democratic presidential debate, the top 10 candidates clashing in Houston. It's the first time frontrunner Joe Biden shared the stage with Elizabeth Warren, one of the leading progressive candidates in the race. But most of the standout moments came from Tier 2 candidates last night, such as this big one from former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke.
And in Odessa, I met the mother of a 15-year-old girl who was shot by an AR-15. Mm-hmm. And that mother watched her bleed to death over the course of an hour because so many other people were shot by that AR-15 in Odessa and Midland. There weren't enough ambulances to get to them in time. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against
Beto O'Rourke with some Texas real talk when it comes to guns. Shauna Thomas, you're from Houston. Here's some Houston privilege. What did we learn last night?
You know, I think talking specifically about Beto O'Rourke after the El Paso shooting, it's very clear that he decided to make his campaign sort of about guns and assault weapons. And he has been traveling to some places that you wouldn't normally travel to if you're running in a Democratic primary to push that message. And so he continued to push it. It seems like some of that was definitely planned. They immediately had merchandise out on their website. But that sort of him going so far in the assault weapons ban, I thought was really interesting because it's such an easy thing for Republicans to kind of turn around and say, hey, look, the Democrats, if you're going to paint them with a broad brush, want to actually take all your guns away. It's not about magazines. It's not about, background checks. It's about actually taking your guns.
Is that true even if Beto at this point is pretty unlikely to be president? I mean, he's in the sort of mid to the bottom of the second tier. I guess he could surge back. But if none of the top tier, if Joe Biden's never saying that and Elizabeth Warren is never saying that, are the rest of the Democrats vulnerable then on this charge?
I'm not saying it's totally true for everybody, but I am saying that in terms of a 2020 campaign and the kind of spin that we expect to see in this kind of campaign, Republicans will say, you know, over in this corner, they don't want to build a wall. They want to decriminalize crossing the border. Over in this corner, they want to take your guns away. This is about creating a narrative, and President Trump is pretty good at creating that narrative, and Beto sort of helped him. Now, if you want to get out of that second tier you were talking about, you got to have a stronger message, and that's what he's going for.
Making a moment on national TV because you don't get a lot of chances. Eliana, where is the race now? It's pretty clear we've got some well-established tiers. This is sort of a convention of primary campaign politics. Biden, Warren, and Sanders at the top. I will tell you this. I did not hear the word impeachment last night at all. It's big news inside the Beltway and in the halls of Congress, but nobody on that national stage last night talked about it.
That's right. It's something that an issue these candidates clearly want to shy away from, but also something that the moderators didn't bring up. And which is interesting given what a dominant subject it is among congressional Democrats. Also didn't hear all that much about the economy, given what important an issue it is for this president in his reelection campaign. One thing I think is surprising is how relatively little tumult there's been in this Democratic field. It's really been, I think, relatively stable. When you look at the Republican race 4 years ago, Scott Walker was a front runner, Ben Carson was a front runner, Ted Cruz was a front runner. We had several different front runners in that race before ultimately Donald Trump overtook them. And it really was thrilling and exciting, I think, for political junkies. This race really has been pretty stable. Nobody has been able to displace Joe Biden as the front runner. Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have always been in that top tier of candidates. And it doesn't look really like any of these debates have changed the fundamental dynamics of the race, or they may not change until we have a nominee.
Shane, I realize I'm mixing rank politics with constitutional imperatives in the House, but on this impeachment question, there was a lot of confusion in the House early this week about what exactly the House Democrats are doing and not doing. And I saw some Democrats endeavoring to clarify by the end of the week that they are pursuing an impeachment procedure, even if they haven't impeached yet. Where are we at?
Well, I'm not sure how much they clarified, actually. So you had Jerry Nadler chairing a hearing where essentially they were setting up rules for what the investigation process might look like. And essentially he said, call it whatever you want. I'm sick of this debate about what he said is nomenclature. Do we have an investigation or an inquiry? Or are we approaching impeachment or kind of coming at it from the side? Speaker Pelosi asked about this, essentially saying she doesn't want to talk about it either, and she will not concede that they're in the midst of an investigation. Look, for all practical intents and purposes, they are in one, right? And they've said as much in court, Democrats have, when they've tried to go to pry records from the administration and saying, we are having an impeachment inquiry here. The words do matter, though, because, of course, the moment that Democrats, particularly leadership, signal we're in a formal impeachment inquiry, then the next question is, okay, so when are the articles of impeachment coming? So it's a little silly kind of to see them dancing around it, but it's very important that they don't quite go over that line. And the nomenclature, contrary to what Congressman Nadler said, it actually does matter quite a bit.
Democrats are wondering where they're going to land on this, and where things land was another story in this orbit this week. What started out as a story about one American Air Force crew landing in Scotland and staying at a Donald Trump golf resort, Dunberg, by the week's end, Shane, turned into a story of busloads of American taxpayer-funded Air Force air crews arriving at a Trump resort to stay overnight when there are cheaper hotels much closer to the airport where they landed. Now, I know I shoved this into the context of an impeachment inquiry. Democrats have been focused on the Mueller report, but is this the kind of thing that could land in an article of impeachment eventually?
It could, absolutely. I mean, we talk about this thing called the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution. It's actually clauses. You can't take money essentially from a foreign source or potentate, and the U.S. government can't pay the president in excess of what his salary is. So the question becomes, is effectively this is what's going on here, is that the military is putting money in the president's pocket. Now, this is not a new issue. This question of the president making money off people staying at his properties, it hasn't
been
not just
people.
Military service.
Right. Taxpayer funded.
And he
people.
Is the commander in chief. I mean, he could presumably tell them where to stay. There's no indication he's actually directed them to do it yet. There are a number of things that are not Mueller and not Russia related that absolutely could become potential. I think it's a question of what the appetite is for impeachment among Democrats. It seems quite low. And whether or not these things resonate with the American people as scandalous to the point of being intolerable, because a lot of about what the president has done, a lot of Democrats think is scandalous, but I think they'd rather address that at the ballot box.
Shauna, I want to ask you, if I can, though, about the president and his reelection prospects. Pretty strong. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to win the nomination, but he did draw another primary challenger this week. We mentioned Mark Sanford, the former congressman, the former governor of South Carolina. What else do we need to know about Mark Sanford?
Well, Mark Sanford lost his reelection to be congressman, and he is very much so a fiscal conservative, kind of old school Republican in that Tea Party vein that we've seen, and has spoken out somewhat against President Trump. He doesn't think Trump represents the fiscal conservatism that he represents, and he's coming out and saying, I want to challenge him. Now, as you alluded to sort of in your intro into this, trying to challenge the sitting president of the United States for a primary is really hard, because every time the president goes out and speaks and does an event, except for maybe last night when he was counter-programmed by a debate on a major network, it's news. And so this is sort of a shot in the dark for people like Mark Sanford or former Congressman Joe Walsh. Part of why Mark Sanford, people say he lost, is he didn't really have the endorsement of the president of the United States in his reelection bid. And Mark Sanford has some issues in his past when it comes to an affair that he had. Mm-hmm. So is he the best, you know, person to carry on the Republican mantle when they actually own the presidency right now? Probably not. But it is interesting more people are coming out. But unless we see members of Congress, sitting members of Congress, other than, I believe, Justin Amash, come out and say, you know what, we don't want this guy to lead us anymore. They're fun interviews to do. Mark Sanford is a great interview. There are interesting people to talk about. It's interesting to talk about this sort of fight within the Republican Party for its identity. But I just don't see this as a credible challenge to the sitting president.
All right. Well, we have a lot more politics to get to. We're going to take a quick break. But before we do, there was some big news via tweet from rap and country star Lil Nas X. That's right. We do a lot of Lil Nas X news on this show. Here's some more. His second single, Panini, is getting the remix treatment. You know Old Town Road. It got a lot of remixes, including K-pop all over the map. Panini is coming out on the remix. Lil Nas X says, how many are you going to get? He says up to 25. Sometimes four. And in my back and not all hundreds. And ain't no time, then I don't go. I be like... It's the Friday News Roundup. More with Politico's Eliana Johnson, Shauna Thomas of Vice News, Shane Harris of the Washington Post, and a little more Lil Nas X. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A. Stay close. Hey, Panini, don't you be a meanie. Thought you wanted me to go. Why you trying to keep me teeny now? Now they need me. Number one, I'm screaming. No, yeah, you used to love me. So what happened? What's the meaning? This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Shane Harris of the Washington Post, who reports on national security and intelligence, Politico White House reporter Eliana Johnson, and Shauna Thomas, the Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News. Speaking of Beto's big moment when it comes to guns on the national debate stage last night, we got this tweet from Phil. Beto never said he would take all the guns. He specifically said he would buy back assault rifles and mentioned AK-47s and AR-15s. Shauna Thomas, is that a distinction with a difference that will land on Donald Trump and conservatives when you predict they'll attack this as a gun takeaway?
I don't think so. I don't think that's I do understand the idea of wanting to be specific about what former Congressman O'Rourke said, but to certain parts of the Republican Party, if you start talking about buybacks and lessening their access to weapons, that is something that they are fearful of, and they don't think the government should do it. I think with Democrats having that issue-based sort of conversation and trying to figure out whose side do you want to be on when it comes to guns is a real thing. But with Republicans, it's just too easy to spin this.
Now, an assault weapons ban is relatively popular with the American public. Some people think this election, we don't know yet, may be won or lost in the suburbs. I want to talk about a race that happened this week, Eliana, that had a big play when it comes to the suburbs, both suburban and rural voters. Let's go to North Carolina, the 9th district in North Carolina. There was a special election. This is still part of the 2018 midterms, believe it or not.
Yep.
Yeah, we're still closing the book on the 2018 midterms, but there was a close race in a district, the North Carolina 9th, that Donald Trump won by 12 points. Now, I'm willing to give you the spoiler here. The Republican won this race, but won it by 2 points. What does that tell us?
Look, I think you can read it both ways, and it's tough to know with these special elections. In 2018, the candidate tampered with ballot boxes. The Republican candidate tampered with ballots, and he only won that race by, I think it was 0.8 points, by an even smaller margin. So this new Republican candidate won by a greater margin than in 2018, but still far less than the margin that Donald Trump won by in 2016, and he got a lot of help from Trump and the vice president, who went down and campaigned for him.
But I want to talk about where that help lands, right? Because the interesting thing about the North Carolina 9th is that it is a mixture of rural voters, Donald Trump and Mike Pence's base. I get it. They're going to really respond to a Trump visit. Suburban voters, where the Republican candidate, now the congressperson elect, did very, very poorly. I came into this talking about an assault weapons ban. And it's true what Shauna says. The Republican base might hate that idea. People in the suburbs, they might be for it.
Right. I mean, I think the takeaway really is that the Republican Party is transforming and it is becoming a more and more rural party. And the Democratic Party, conversely, is becoming an urban party. And I think you can look to those trends to continue as we head into the 2020 election.
Is it true that there's a conventional wisdom developing here? Do you see it that Donald Trump is getting a bigger share of a smaller party? The Republican Party is shrinking. The base is shrinking, even if Donald Trump is getting a stronger hold on it.
I think that's probably right. And Trump is a unique candidate. So I think what I would add to that is simply that because Trump is a unique candidate, it's difficult to know what that says broadly about the GOP. You know, what would a GOP under Nikki Haley be the same sort of party as it would be under Trump? Probably not. But under Trump, certainly the party is becoming a much more rural party with a smaller base. I think that's right.
Shauna, we had a lot of news of the hurricane that hit the Bahamas hard last week. And this week, some of the aftermath, some of the political aftermath here in Washington. There are two congressional committees that are now investigating whether anyone in the White House acted inappropriately to retaliate against weather forecasters at the National Weather Service or the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration when they contradicted the president. All of this after Hurricane Dorian. President Trump has denied, he denied it on Wednesday, that he instructed anyone on his staff to rebuke weather forecasters for contradicting his claims about the threats to Alabama. The New York Times, though, reported that the president did, in fact, set in motion a chain of events that led to the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross threatening to fire top officials at NOAA and tell them that they're going to be out if they don't toe the line. Shauna, this story seems like it might be petty, like it shouldn't matter, like people might roll their eyes. But I wonder if you see it that way.
Well, I have to admit, with the whole Sharpie Gate, which went on for a pretty long time about whether Alabama was in the path of that hurricane that killed many people, basically destroyed part of the Bahamas, I was like, this is not the point, guys. And then this came out about threats against officials within NOAA for doing their jobs. And at that point, it does start to become an important story about how we run our government and what do we allow people to do. And are there any parts of our government where politics doesn't necessarily have to get involved? And I think everyone on this radio show would think that at least something like, okay, this is a science-based organization within the Department of Commerce. We rely on them for information about weather. How could politics ever get involved in this? And somehow this administration managed to do it. And at least according to the New York Times, seemed to think it was okay to threaten people over it. That really, I mean, I think this is one of those things that should play into 2020. And people should think about how do they want their overall government run, especially the parts that shouldn't really involve politics.
And the political operation, whether it's the president or not, threatening scientists at a scientific organization within the government has been branded by some people as a form of corruption, a form of intellectual corruption, if you like. It is an important story.
Which also plays into the impeachment conversation as well. And also brain drain within our government. Why, if you are a scientist, do you want to work for some place that says don't do your job?
Shane, I'm glad you're here, as always, because whenever national security stories come up and we really have to dig in, I'm always glad that you're sitting at the table because there's a fascinating real-world spy thriller. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says it's nonsense. But CNN reported this week that the U.S. had recruited a mid-level Russian official decades ago. He slowly worked his way up the government ranks and landed a top spot in the Kremlin, sending valuable information to the United States over the years. Now, after the 2016 election and concerns that the Trump administration was mishandling covert information, that the president himself was revealing classified information, the U.S. decided to extract this spy. Now, the Kremlin responded to the story with a big yawn, saying that he was kind of a boozy nobody, downplaying that this person was important. Media outlets have identified this spy as Oleg B. Smolenkov, What do we know about Oleg? Is he real, and how important was he?
Well, we know he's a real person. he owns a house out in Stafford, Virginia, which I went out and visited, did not find him at home this week. We don't know 100% that he is this individual that's been reported by CNN and confirmed by us and the New York Times and others that was providing information about the election interference, but his profile very closely matches that person, and the Kremlin has strongly suggested that he might be. If this is true, I mean, there's a way in which this is actually something of a good news story in that the CIA was able to recruit an asset very well placed within the inner circle of the Russian leadership. That's kind of a golden source in espionage. We don't have many of those, and we really haven't had many of those in Russia, even going back to the Cold War. So if this individual was the one who was providing information about Russian election interference, and particularly Vladimir Putin's direction of it, that becomes a very critical piece of understanding how it is that the intelligence community was so certain back in 2016 that Putin was weighing in, trying to influence the election, and that he had a preference for which candidate.
Because they may have had eyes on him for real.
Exactly. And certainly had other technical intelligence trying back to them. But when you've also got somebody who's kind of vouching for this thing that you're seeing from what you're tracking on the computer and what you're seeing any other intelligence, that's huge.
Now, what about the cause here? The initial reporting on this story said that Oleg, if he's the guy, was pulled in part because of fear and distrust about the president's ability to keep the lid on classified information. They were afraid that the president might burn him. That not only burns a source, but could cost him his life. Later reporting, I think including your reporting, downplayed that part of the story, said no, it was because it was clear the United States knew about election interference and that Oleg was the guy who had eyes on that, and they extracted him as a matter of good spycraft. How do we understand the discrepancy, or is there one here?
Well, I think there is something of a discrepancy. I mean, we should be clear, too, that it's rare. It's usually not the case, and I don't think it's the case here, that it's simply one event that might be tangential to the matter, like the president revealing some information, by the way, about counterterrorism and ISIS to Russian officials that had nothing to do with election interference. That would not necessarily prompt the CIA to say, quick, get the guy out of there. But I think it is totally the case that in the context of this decision to bring this person out, I think because of the building scrutiny around this question of, well, how did we know that Vladimir Putin ordered this election interference? I mean, we knew covering this that the signs were pointing to a spy in the Kremlin pretty early on, and certainly the Russians understood that. But in the context of that, you do have an intelligence community that is very on edge because the president is so undisciplined when it comes to information security and kind of keeping close to the vest how it is that we know what we know about counterterrorism and ISIS and the like. And not the proximate cause of what happened, but certainly I think that was in the minds of officials when they were contemplating bringing this guy out of Russia.
Now, hold that thought, because I want to stick with national security, and this one's for you too, Shane. The national security advisor, John Bolton, gone. He's the fourth national security advisor for this White House. He says he resigned. The president says he was fired, and the president spoke about it as the week progressed.
John wasn't in line with what we were doing. And actually, in some cases, he thought it was too tough what we were doing. Mr. Tough Guy, you know, you have to go into Iraq. Going into Iraq was something that he felt very strongly about. So we're right now in for over $7 trillion into the Middle East. And I don't say it was his decision. You had a president and you had other people also, but he was very out there, I can tell you, and wanting to have them do it.
Shane Harris, where does this leave American foreign policy?
Well, not any more or less chaotic than it already was. Donald Trump knew all those things about John Bolton, by the way, and he hired him anyway. And never made any pretense about having some concerns about what he called his hawkishness, which I think is true. But Donald Trump is his own national security advisor. I mean, John Bolton was probably the most vivid illustration of how there's no internal process for making policy and foreign policy in this administration. He very much tried to close the door on that. But there really wasn't a process even with the previous national security advisors. Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, is the one who has figured out how to really have influence with this president and be an advisor to him. And it largely revolves around not contradicting him, either publicly or privately, which is something that John Bolton did all the time, and you see what happened.
And now, as the White House looks for a replacement, there's even trial balloons going up that Mike Pompeo might take over both jobs, Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. That's the Henry Kissinger model. A lot of people have remembered and noticed that it's the Henry Kissinger model, wondering if they want to return to those days. You're listening to 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. Let's talk immigration, Eliana, because the Supreme Court signed off on the Trump administration's move this week to limit asylum claims for people coming from Central America. This rule, quote, prohibits migrants who have resided in or traveled through third countries from seeking asylum in the United States, therefore barring people traveling through Mexico from being able to claim asylum at all, according to CNN. Remind us again what applying for asylum means and what the Supreme Court ruling means now.
Right. I think that's not quite an accurate description. It bans people coming from Central America for applying for asylum if they haven't already applied for asylum in the first country they traveled through. So Hondurans and Salvadorans have to seek and be denied asylum in either Guatemala or Mexico before they can apply for asylum in the United States. Guatemalans have to do that in Mexico. So really, it's like the U.S. has to be a last resort for these people. And asylum seekers, the definition really is that they have to be fleeing persecution and fear for their lives in their home country. And the definition even, the Trump administration has sought to tighten. But really, the Supreme Court issued a very short ruling with only two dissents in it, saying that this should be allowed to go through a fuller court process. Immigrants' rights group were seeking a more expeditious decision from the court. But this will now go all the way through the court system, which could take many months, came as a disappointment to these immigrant rights groups. But the policy could still ultimately be overturned.
Shauna, put this ruling from the Supreme Court in the broader context of the immigration debate and how the White House is driving the bus here.
I mean, I think we have to go back to this idea that 2020 is looming. The president of the United States is running for re-election. And the main thing one of the biggest things he ran on in 2016 was building a wall and changing how we do immigration in this country and limiting immigration, whether that be legal or illegal with this administration. And so what this does is this is something very concrete that he can now point to and say, you know what? I want to limit the people who are coming through Mexico, who are coming from those Central American countries. I have put this in place. The Supreme Court has at least upheld it temporarily as it works through that process that Eliana talked about. And I am trying to protect you. I am trying to make sure people don't take your jobs away. That is the message the president has very consistently been using since 2016. And here's something concrete he can now point to. Since he cannot point to an actual wall or any new wall that has been built since he ran in 2016. So that's sort of the larger 2020 context. And I think in another way, it does show sort of where the presidency has power versus where it doesn't. And in this case, when it comes to especially foreign policy, sort of talking about John Bolton before, and immigration, those are things that the executive branch can manipulate. And we now have a Supreme Court that's saying, okay, you can do what you want, President Trump, on this as we play the whole process out, instead of a lot of the other things that have had injunctions put on them.
Shane?
Yeah, and I think that's right. The president has, I mean, we remember one of the first acts he ever took in office was this ban on people coming from predominantly Muslim countries. And the way it was written immediately kind of ran into the buzzsaw of the courts. Then they figured out how to write it. And I think if the broad sort of arc, the long arc of this immigration narrative with the administration is they are figuring out, as Shauna said, the places where the president has authority. And he has tremendous authorities, any president, when it comes to these kinds of security issues. And they're playing it where they can. And this will allow him, if it plan works out for him, to be able to go to the voters and say, look, I told you I was going to crack down on crossings at the border. I did that. How he did it is not necessarily, I think, going to be so important for Republican voters. It will be a huge issue, of course, for Democratic voters.
We talked about the base at the top of this discussion and the ways the president can bring out his base. This is surely one. But does he risk also the left is very exercised about these immigration announcements and rulings? You risk energizing the other base as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he has. And I think it then becomes incumbent, obviously, on the Democratic nominee to make sure that they stay energized.
All right, we're going to take a short break. But just ahead,
it's called vaping, especially vaping as it pertains to innocent children. And they're coming home and they're saying, Mom, I want to vape. And the parents don't know too much about it. And nobody knows too much about it.
We're going to catch up on some health headlines next when the Friday News Roundup continues with Eliana Johnson of Politico, Shane Harris of The Washington Post, and Shauna Thomas of Vice News. You're listening to the Friday News Roundup. I'm Todd Zwillick. Stay close. Well, as we return to the news of the week, the country continues to contend with the opioid crisis. And this week, we saw new developments in the case against Purdue Pharma. That's the company that created OxyContin, a highly addictive painkiller that the multi-state lawsuit that's been in play for well over a year in this country, a couple of years, says fueled the opioid crisis. According to a survey by NBC, officials from 27 states have agreed to the terms of a settlement with Purdue, but at least 21 others rejected those terms. Maggie Fox is here with us in the studio. Maggie is a longtime health and science and medical reporter here in Washington, D.C. She's freelance. She's an esteemed colleague of mine. Maggie, I'm glad you're here to help us understand some of the complex health news of the week. What are the terms of this offer between the Sackler family, their company, Purdue Pharma, maker of OxyContin, oxycodone, and state attorneys general and victims?
Well, the Sackler family has made an offer to basically liquidate their company. They're going to offer $3 billion from the company itself. They're offering another $1.5 billion, a possible total of $12 billion over time. In return, they want to go into Chapter 11. And that's why some of the other states are objecting to this agreement. They say, actually, Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family are wiggling out of a lot of their commitments. They say the family's been pulling money out of the company over time. Their accusation is that it's in anticipation of an agreement like this. And they say the money being offered is not going to be anywhere near enough to take care of all the problems that have been caused by the opioid crisis.
Well, the Attorney General in Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, tweeted this. I'm quoting, Purdue Pharma has provided an insultingly weak offer to the American people for the opioid epidemic that they fueled for decades. It allows them to walk away billionaires and admit no wrongdoing. I don't accept that. If Attorney General Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania does not accept that, and it's pretty clear he doesn't, where does it leave the settlement? Where does it leave victims? Where does it leave the Sackler family?
Well, it leaves a lot of it up in the air because, of course, in at least 21 states, there's still going to be lawsuits going on. It doesn't take the Sackler family off the hook. These kinds of settlements are complicated. This is what the U.S. went through back in the 90s with the comprehensive tobacco settlement with the tobacco companies. And they ended up with hundreds of billions of dollars that went to the states, but it took a long time to negotiate. It ended up with many compromises that a lot of tobacco advocates were unhappy with. And, of course, this is one company and one family. There's lots of companies that have made opioids that are the subject of lawsuits by states and by localities who say, you know what, you really push these drugs on doctors, you push these drugs on patients, you told people they weren't safe, you marketed them in unethical ways, and we want all of you to pay. The Sacklers and the Purdue company have been the focus of this particular settlement, but at least a lot of stuff out in the open yet.
And there are other settlements that have already been executed in places like Oklahoma. Well, last question on this, Maggie. If Pennsylvania, one big state, says not good enough, there are other states out there that say not good enough, what is the point when a settlement deal can be made? Does any one state have veto power? Can they leave the deal and sue separately? How does it work?
Well, yes. I mean, states, of course, can sue separately. It'll be up to the federal courts to try to negotiate, try to coordinate something bigger and better. In the meantime, it's going to be a bit of a free-for-all.
All right. I want to get to another huge health story while you're here, Maggie. And we've already teased it a little bit this hour. It's on vaping. Smoking cigarettes is way down in this country. That's good news. But millions and millions of Americans are still addicted to nicotine. We learned this week, in a surprise, that the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, is going to step in on a crisis. Here's President Trump once again talking to the press this week.
Vaping has become a very big business, as I understand it, like a giant business in a very short period of time. But we can't allow people to get sick, and we can't have our youth be so affected. And I'm hearing it, and that's how the First Lady got involved. And she's got a son together that is a beautiful young man, and she feels very, very strongly about it.
president of the United States giving his justification for a limited vaping ban. Now, the Secretary of Health and Human Services announced that in the coming weeks, the Food and Drug Administration, under his purview, would release a plan to remove flavored e-cigarette and nicotine pods from the market. Maggie, what is this, a ban? And the real question is, why now?
Well, ban's not a great word for this. In 2016, the FDA said that anyone who wanted to sell e-cigarettes had to go through the FDA approval process. They then put that on hold. The former FDA commissioner, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, said, you know what, they need until 2022 to do this because we've only just started the framework for the rules. The companies don't even know what they're going to have to do to get through our process. Now, the Trump administration says they're going to roll that back and have directed the FDA to come up with a new set of rules through which the e-cigarette manufacturers are going to have to seek FDA approval for their products. The FDA can, in the meantime, say you may not market your products until you get approval. It's not exactly a ban.
What's the distinction between flavored vaping, flavored e-cigarettes, flavors like, you know, Jolly Rancher, birthday cake, clearly marketed to get kids hooked, and vaping products that tastes like a cigarette and nobody would probably like it except an adult or at least a teenager or later?
Well, of course, the e-cigarette manufacturers say that adults do like these products. Almost everybody else says, yeah, these are aimed at kids. Nicotine has a nasty flavor. And that's one of the problems with e-cigarettes in general is that the makers use a product called nicotine salts to make it taste a little less nasty. Apparently, that also gets it into your blood faster, gets it into your system faster. That's one objection that advocates have. And of course, these flavors, when you survey teenagers and young kids, they name the flavors overall as the main reason they're attracted to the e-cigarettes, especially the fruity flavors and the candy flavors.
Well, listeners are chiming in on this point. Nicholas says hundreds of thousands die every year from cigarettes, yet there's no call for a ban there. And Bill asks this on Twitter, why are people more concerned with vaping than they are with regular cigarettes? And this gets to a couple of disturbing points in the data, Maggie. Teen smoking is way, way down over the last two decades. But I saw a disturbing chart that came out yesterday or the day before that shows that decline curve spiking back up when it comes to vaping. All of those kids, I say all of the percentage of kids who've given up cigarettes have grabbed a hold of vapes and they're using nicotine again.
Even more disturbing, Todd, it's kids who never smoked, never even thought of smoking. Teen smoking is, as you say, way down. And the latest preliminary figures from the CDC show that 27.5% of kids say that they are, recent e-cigarette users. The definition is if you've tried one in the past 30 days, you're considered a current user. That is way more than kids ever smoked. There's many, many more kids vaping than ever used traditional cigarettes, and that's what's so troubling. Also troubling is that, of course, these are great nicotine delivery vehicles, and there's a lot of evidence to show that kids are way more easily addicted than adults are, and also that nicotine has effects on their brains. Further troubling, the kids have no idea what's in these e-cigarettes. Many don't realize nicotine is in them. Many don't realize it's addictive. And a lot of people, hardly anybody knows what's actually in the flavoring products. And that brings up another troubling event. Recent event is these six people who have died apparently because of vaping. Another more than 200, close to 300 people who have been made ill, according to the CDC.
That's contamination, a whole separate issue from the long-term chronic effects of vaping. This is an acute illness.
This is an acute illness. It's not clear if it's contamination or if it's a deliberate part of the e-cigarette formula. Nobody's quite clear yet whether these are homemade vapes, whether it's people who have been vaping cannabis or THC or CBD oil. It's very unclear. What is clear is that it causes a really severe form of pneumonia that puts almost every patient into the hospital. About a third of them have to go on ventilators. It's not clear what their long-term outcomes are. And if six people have died, that's serious.
Well, Maggie, here's a complicated question. Easier to answer when it comes to kids. we don't want them vaping. We'll see if the White House and the FDA follow through on anything that could look like a ban for candy-flavored vaping to maybe discourage kids to stay off it. But a lot of experts have warned that while we don't want kids vaping, vaping could be less dangerous than cigarettes. And if adults are vaping instead of smoking, that could be for the overall good. They call it harm reduction, and they say it's a little counterintuitive, but if grown adults are vaping, maybe they're not smoking Marlboros, which we know are dangerous, and maybe it actually helps.
Well, there is some evidence that it can help people transition away from cigarettes, but it's not entirely clear. What is clear is that kids who have never smoked before are vaping. It's also clear that kids who vape are more likely to go on and try and use tobacco. It gets very, very messy because, you know, some people are arguing if you ban vapes, you're going to just send kids back to cigarettes. You're going to send adults back to cigarettes. So what do you do? But it's also clear that the companies who make these products have not proven that they help people quit smoking. They have not proven that their products are safer than cigarettes. And what the FDA is saying now is, well, if you're going to say these things, and these companies are saying those things, you need to prove it.
I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A. Well, gang, before we round out the hour, I want to return us to California. We had some news on immigration from California. We mentioned an upcoming show on Monday here on 1A about labor and labor markets and Uber and other companies and labor rules in California. Now, the Trump administration is planning a major crackdown on California's homelessness issue, one which might include destroying encampments in some major cities. Shauna, what's the background here? How bad is the homelessness problem in California, and why is President Trump suddenly interested?
Well, the homelessness problem in California is pretty bad, especially in the Los Angeles area, and it's something that has been in the news there for a long time. And how do you make sure these people have some place to live? For me, it's a little unclear why President Trump latched on to this particular issue. Now, it has been reported that Rudy Giuliani said that President Trump internally at the White House has been talking about the homeless issue, and that there are spaces the administration had gone out and had started sort of looking for places to put more homeless people in Los Angeles. But the weird thing about this issue is it didn't seem like we were going into a lot of details about why these people were homeless, just where can you put them? And that's a very strange conversation to have.
Yeah. Eliana, what are they talking about in terms of solutions? Shauna's right. They're not talking about root causes. They're talking about getting people rounded up off the street and where to house them.
That's right. Yeah. No talk about what's caused these people to be on the streets. But the president is contemplating a trip out to California next week, potentially to look at some sites. There was talk of an airplane hangar of some sorts or an FAA facility where the homeless in Los Angeles could there would be an effort to move them from outside to inside. So it does seem in some sense like a cosmetic solution to really a festering problem, both in Los Angeles and in San Francisco.
What is President
right
Trump,
now,
and, what is
unless
the,
there's more detail that we haven't gotten.
What is the president trying to do here? Is he trying to show that he's the one who's tackling this problem when the big city mayors aren't?
I think there's part of that. And I think it's also part of a kind of tough on crime, tough on tough on immigration approach, where he says he's going to clean up problems in these urban areas where state and city officials haven't been able to.
Well, Shane, what's the authority here? There have been a lot of questions about this. Does the federal government have the legal right to parachute into an American city, Los Angeles in this case, and commandeer an issue like this?
I don't think so. I mean, the federal government doesn't have the right to round you up and necessarily put you in an abandoned FAA facility. I'm not sure this has been thought through, which, I mean, this often happens with kind of policies in the White House. Would the state have jurisdiction here that they would say the federal government's preempting? I mean, there's so much of it that's not really clear. Putting aside, you know, the optics of it, does the president really want to be, rounding people up in buses and moving them out to a camp? I mean, this is particularly at a time when the immigration debate is so heated. It doesn't seem to me that the White House has fully baked this thing and really thought through what the legal implications are and what the jurisdictional ones are. The president, I think, just wants to maybe, this is kind of an out of sight, out of mind solution, perhaps.
Have there been any negotiations with local officials on the city council council or the mayor's office or even officials in California about this that we know about?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I think some of these officials are finding out about this in news reports and are saying that they have not been having detailed conversations with the White House about this.
Well, we will see if this trial balloon from the White House winds up in court, winds up sort of dying under its own weight, or becomes an actual policy from the Trump administration. Well, it's almost time to go, and it is our tradition to end the Friday News Roundup with an offbeat story of the week, kind of send you on your way with a spring in your step. But it is Friday the 13th, so let's not tempt fate. Maybe we'll just bring the show to an easy end before anything freaky happens there in the control room and we have some kind of technical snafu on Friday the 13th. This is live radio after all. Well, talk about technical snafus. Folks, you just heard one in real time. I thought we were going to have some bad luck music there, and we wound up with a little bit of dead air. I don't mind telling you that because it's Friday the 13th, and that's exactly the kind of thing that happens on a day like this. Imagine that, trying to make a joke and then it becomes real. Count your lucky stars on a day like this. Superstition is real sometimes. I want to thank all of my guests for being here. Shauna Thomas, Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News. Thanks for joining us, Shauna.
Thank you. And I just want to say thank you to Denise Couture, your supervising senior producer, who has been incredibly great every time I've been on 1A.
Today is Denise's last Friday News Roundup after many, many years of producing, and we congratulate her. Shauna, thank you. Shane Harris is an intelligence national security reporter for The Washington Post. Eliana Johnson, White House reporter for Politico, and Maggie Fox, who writes on health and science. Maggie, great to see you. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, is distributed on all days, not just Friday the 13th, by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Joshua is back on Monday. Thanks so much for listening. This is 1A.